Next case is In Re SawStop Holding, 2021-2161. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Fanning. Please proceed.
Thank you, and may it please the court. This appeal asks the question whether the judiciary has the authority to adopt a doctrine that imposes an additional requirement of patentability.
Mr. Fanning, we don't answer questions. We decide cases.
Very good.
And isn't there precedent on the only issue that you're raising before us?
There is precedent. The AbbVie case, of course, says that the doctrine of obviousness-type double patenting continues after the URAA amendments. But SawStop submits that no case has ever addressed the question of whether the fundamental issue of whether the judiciary can adopt such a doctrine has been addressed. No, as far as we've been able to tell, no case has addressed that. So before you can decide, you know, does the doctrine of obviousness type double patenting continue to apply after the URAA amendments or something, you have to decide whether the doctrine itself is valid.
But why should we decide this?
Because it's preventing inventors from getting patents that Congress says they should get.
Well, shouldn't Congress decide this?
I think Congress has. That's the point. The doctrine...
Has Congress directed us to follow a certain path?
I haven't... Not as I understand the question, no. Although Congress has said in the statutes, 101, 102, and 103, a patent shall be granted if... And if, and if, and none of those, they all exclude the doctrine of obviousness type double patenting. It's an extra thing. I know it's uncomfortable.
The 52 Patent Act added Section 253, which yes. provided for terminal disclaimers, which the CCPA over and over again said the purpose of that was to accommodate non-statutory double patenting.
Yeah.
So Congress obviously is fully aware of what you're calling a judge-made doctrine.
Yeah, I think Congress is aware. Now, as far as I've been able to determine, I haven't seen any legislative history or congressional history saying that. I know the CCPA, and I think this court has recognized that 253, is it 2 or something, the terminal disclaimer portion, the bottom portion of that, is used to in response to obviate, if that's the right word, double patenting rejection, obviously type double patenting rejection. Now, but it still seems... That's contrary to statute. At least that's what SawStop believes. You know, it says...
You're familiar with Zickendrott.
I am.
The CCPA opinion. You cited it in your blue brief.
And I did.
You cited Judge Rich's concurrence in particular. And Judge Rich's concurrence specifically points out that before the 52 Patent Act, there really wasn't an obviousness type patentability condition in the patent statute before 1952. And so all of that obviousness law was judge-made law, right? I guess your position would be that all of that pre-52 Act law was invalid.
Yeah, you know, that's a tough one. I think that's right, though.
Okay. You know, so the Supreme Court just went off the rails with its pre-52 Act obviousness law.
Well, if we have...
jump the tracks, the ditch, upside down, wheels spinning in the air, smoke's going up into the sky.
Well, I guess technically I will say yes to that because I want to be consistent. But if you look, our system is based on Congress.
The doctrine of equivalence also an invalid doctrine?
I don't know. I haven't thought about that one.
How about the judge made exceptions to Section 101? Abstract idea, laws of nature, natural phenomena.
Yeah, those are based in the wording of the statute. My understanding is that the court interprets the words of 101 and says that's what these things mean, which is, I think, the correct role of the court, to interpret the statutes. But where the statutes are silent...
I believe the courts have said that there's some implicit exception. There's nothing in the statute to... There's nothing grounded in the statute when it comes to the judicial exceptions to Section 101.
There's the words of 101 themselves. You know, what does it mean to have an article of manufacture? What does it mean to have a composition of matter? You know, and so you look at those words, you read the statute and look at those words. We don't know, so you interpret it. But for the doctrine of obviousness type double patenting, no such thing. To the contrary, the Congress has set a scheme, and it's preventing SawStop from getting a patent that meets the, you know, SawStop filed a patent application, meets all the statutory requirements, every one, except for this judicially created doctrine. And now SawStop can't have its patent. Congress says it can. The court says it can't. No, that's SawStop's point. That's SawStop's point.
You say you can't have your patent. Who decided that? Who told you that?
The patent office rejected it.
And are you appealing that decision?
Yeah, that's what this is.
That's what this, but you're not, I don't see any merits here. It's just a legal question you're raising. You want us to overrule our precedent and to eliminate this, the ODP doctrine.
Yes, and by doing so, then you reverse the PTAB's decision based on that doctrine. And so SawStop then goes back to the patent office. The patent office can no longer, do obviousness type double patenting, so there's no other bar to patentability for the application, so the application issues, and SawStop gets its patent.
You say the patent office won't give them a patent, but if they file the terminal disclaimer, they would, right?
That's correct.
So they can get a patent.
Yeah, with a terminal disclaimer. But why should an inventor have to disclaim term that Congress says it should get, is our point. You know, Congress defines these terms, and you know, if you just read the statute and apply it, these terms can vary. And that's what SawStop has done, and that's what SawStop is requesting. Just let SawStop have the patent that Congress, the scheme adopted by the Congress, says it should have. And we recognize it's an uncomfortable thing. You know, it's many, many cases with the doctrine of obviousness type double patenting for a long, long time.
You show courage in bringing this issue before us, yes, but I don't see the basis yet.
I guess as simple as I can say it, Congress says you can have a patent if you satisfy the conditions of 101, 102, and 103. None of those statutes.
We have interpreted those provisions, and along the way, the ODP doctrine was created.
Yeah, my understanding is that the ODP doctrine is separate from those statutes. It's a judicially created doctrine. It's not a statutorily created doctrine. And that's the error. The court should not, the judiciary should not legislate and add a fourth requirement of patentability. Know that this claim...
You want us to rule unconstitutional our past practice with respect to ODP?
Yes. Yes, because I think, unfortunately...
Your argument is this is the domain for Congress and not for the court.
Yes. And Congress has spoken. Yes.
But Congress did not say eliminate the ODP.
I've not seen Congress say that, but I have seen Congress say a patent shall be...
In the Uruguay Round Act, when it established the filing date requirements, it could have addressed it. It was Congress is aware of the ODP doctrine that this court has consistently applied for years.
You know what?
Maybe Congress has already answered your question.
I think it has in our favor, Your Honor, because it could have also... statutorily implemented the ODP. And in fact, if I remember right, there was a provision proposed to make obviousness type double patenting statutory. You actually had a provision, and it was rejected. Instead, Congress didn't do it. They didn't say anything.
But they don't tell us to stop it.
But they do say to grant a patent if 101, 102, and 103 are met. And that's the point. They may not say something, but silence doesn't mean... They approve it. It doesn't mean anything.
I think in this case it may mean that. In this case, Congress asked the question. It goes to the root of ODP, and that's what's the critical date of a patent? Is it when it's filed, or is it when it's conceived? And Congress answered that question, and they didn't tell us. Therefore, the ODP. doctrine doesn't apply anymore.
Yeah. So I guess I see your point. And, I've thought about it a lot. And I can't find, obviously, Congress saying, throw out ODP.
Counsel, you wanted to save quite a bit of time.
Thank you.
We understand your point. And we'll save it for you. Mr. LaMacher. All right, let us proceed. Mr. LaMacher, everything you said so far has to be repeated, but I'm sure you'll be discreet.
I was just apologizing. I don't know what happened. I lost the last 3 or 4 minutes of appellant's argument, but I did catch the first front, most of it, and I understand from his briefs his point, and I have a response for the court if you'd like to hear it.
Yes.
As we pointed out in a brief, we believe the obvious type double patenting doctrine is binding precedent not only on the agency but on this panel as well. And they don't dispute, appellant does not dispute the merits of the double patenting rejection. They don't dispute the claim construction. They don't dispute the teachings of what's in the claims or that they are indistinct from each other. The only thing that they do dispute is the law. They believe that the court was not authorized to ever create the doctrine. And I guess their main point, which I heard appellant assert here in their opening argument, is that they don't believe there's any statutory support, that it's somehow outside the statute. But we did cite in our brief the AbbVie case and the Gilead case, and they both give a good historical overview of the doctrine. And they do point out in AbbVie, for example, quote, while it's often described as a court-created doctrine, obviousness-type double patenting is grounded in the text of the Patent Act. And I believe what AbbVie court was trying to say is that when you look at Section 101, Section 101 provides a patent applicant, but when they become a patentee, a patent for a invention. They don't get two patents on a invention. They get a patent on an invention. And yes, appellant would say, well, but that's identical double patenting. That's statutory. We're talking about obviousness type, and that's correct. Here we've got a slight variation, but it's merely an obvious variant. And what the court has done, and it goes back, I think it goes back long before the court, the Zickenkrot case that was mentioned earlier, I think it goes back over 100 years as articulated in the Gilead decision. Way back, I think Justice Story even, there's a quote from Justice Story that he said, look, it can't be that a patentee can obtain two patents in sequence substantially for the same invention and improvements, and it would be completely destroy the whole consideration derived by the public for a grant of a patent, the right to use the invention at the expiration of the term. And the point is, yes, Congress contemplated and understood what double patenting is, because Congress said, we're not going to let you get more than what we've given you. What we've given you is a particular term, a particular time period of limited protection that you get, that limited exclusion of that patent. We're not going to let you string together patent after patent after patent and extend that beyond what you've got. So where the real statutory support is historically is it's in the term of the statute itself. It's true, applicant comes forth with a second application, and that second application gets examined for all the other provisions of the statute, and yeah, the agency writes an obviousness type double patenting doctrine based on the historical developed doctrine from the courts, but what's really happening is the agency is saying, we're not going to let you go out into the world with two separate patents that have two claims in them that effectively cover the same invention. That would be violating your limited term that Congress gave you. Congress understood what a limited term was, and they're not going to let you make minor changes to circumvent what they statutorily authorize. So I said, in a sense, that's where the statute lies for the statutory acknowledgement of the doctrine. And I think Judge Chen mentioned earlier, there's also Section 253 where, yes, they don't expressly state in the
legislative
history.
Counsel, Mr. LaMarca?
I apologize. Go ahead, Your Honor.
Why is it that Congress did not codify the ODP doctrine? If what you say is true, if the PTO office issues a patent based on criteria that's grounded in the statute, what right does a court have to come along and take it away?
Well, Your Honor, I don't look upon it as the court taking it away. I think what the agency is doing, consistent with the court's doctrine, is the agency is ensuring that two patents don't go out the door that effectively cover the same thing. That's what the agency is protecting against, and they're following the court's doctrine.
But what does Congress say that?
So I don't believe that there is an additional requirement of patentability, which is what appellant has argued. I believe it's the same requirement that you get a patent covering a invention, and simply obvious variants of that thing. The public has all, for hundreds of years, all the way back over 100 years, the public has always had a right to rely on the expiration of that term, and then that they could realize that claim, that patent claim or obvious variants of it, were then available to the public domain.
Would you say the addition of the obviousness point is statutorily grounded in 103?
Well, I don't know that I'd say it's grounded in 103. I think 103 is the test used to help compare the two claims, Your Honor. 103, by definition, requires the two patents to be prior art, one of them to be prior art to the other. And here, prior art is not relevant. It doesn't matter that the one claim is not prior art to the other. The bottom line is the doctrine prevents an applicant or a patentee from having two claims covering the same subject matter or improperly extending the term of their protected invention. That's what it protects against. So the reason why I wouldn't say it's 103 is because 103 requires it to be prior art. But 103 is a test used to help compare the two claims to determine whether or not they are distinct or indistinct, right? That's the purpose of 103. I don't know if that's helpful for your question, Your Honor.
Mr. LaMarca, do you think the doctrine, assuming for the moment that obviousness-type double patenting is a judicial gloss on what I'll call same-invention double patenting, do you think the obviousness-type double patenting doctrine, its genesis comes from the Supreme Court or the CCPA or some other court?
If we look at the Gilead decision, Your Honor, which I'm sure you're familiar with because I believe
yes,
that might
yes.
be for yours. There's a long recitation of the history in there of the doctrine. And it does point out in, I think, footnote 4 of the Gilead decision. And let me turn to that because that
cites
footnote.
Many cases. I'm just trying to figure out what the PTO thinks. Does the PTO think the origins of obviousness type double patenting come from the Supreme Court as opposed to, say, the CCPA, such that this court, the Federal Circuit, lacks the authority to even overturn this particular doctrine, assuming for the moment it is, in fact, a judge-made doctrine?
Yeah, I think right now our position is we are bound by Federal Circuit and CCPA precedent, and we don't believe that there's any Supreme Court law that conflicts with it or that it violates Supreme Court law. In fact, when we read these cases, the history of the doctrine goes back to, like I said earlier, the concept that you're entitled to your limited term, and if you try to go beyond that term, that is a fundamental principle that even is embedded in Supreme Court case law, that you're entitled to your limited term, but you don't get to extend that term beyond the statutory length. And therefore, the obviousness type double patenting doctrine is ensuring that the term is what you were rewarded by the grant and that you don't get to go beyond it. So arguably, the historical Supreme Court case law is in support of this doctrine, but we don't see any conflict in Supreme Court case law with the doctrine, nor do we see conflict in the statute because, as you pointed out earlier, there are other provisions in the statute that, in effect, reflect that Congress is fully aware of the ODP doctrine, Section 253, I believe you mentioned, but there's also Section 121, which is the restriction statute, which also contains a provision that if the agency makes a restriction requirement and divides an application into two separate inventions, that the agency cannot come back and make a double patenting rejection because they've said on the record that it's divisible. So the point is, Congress is aware of the doctrine. The statute's been recodified and amended many times, and Congress has never, ever expressed any reason why the doctrine wasn't valid. And in fact, those codifications basically support the doctrine that show that it is valid, that it's embedded in many, many, many years of case law. And not only that, the terminal disclaimer concept, which you pointed out, Section 253, which provides the ability to do a disclaimer, that became a tool to help these applicants. Appellants said, hey, we're not allowing the applicants to get the patent that they deserve. Well, yes, we are. We're allowing an applicant that has an obviousness type double patenting rejection to get their patent. That's the whole benefit of the terminal disclaimer, by disclaiming that tail end of the term and making the terms the same and committing that the two patents would be joined together as a single patent. We are giving the applicant their patent for the term that Congress allowed them to have. We're not giving them more term. We're giving them the statutory term. And I believe the Gilead case cites an old case called Robeson, R-O-B-E-S-O-N, which explains that as well. So I think there is plenty of statutory support for the doctrine, even though it may not be precisely or expressly written into the statute. And I think, as you might have even pointed out, keep in mind, the courts have the authority to make doctrines that are not expressly in the statute. I think you pointed out there's the doctrine of equivalence. You pointed out there's even a doctrine called assigner estoppel, which recently went to the Supreme Court, which was an equitable doctrine not expressly in the statute. And I can think of others as well. For example, the reissue statute, Your Honor. Long before the reissue statute was ever codified, reissue was a judicially created doctrine that was later codified, just like you pointed out, Section 103. In some of these cases, it says Section 103, obviousness, was first a judicially created doctrine and ultimately codified. So yeah.
Counsel,
my point is,
counsel,
in our view,
counsel, as I said before, applicant wasn't denied a patent here. Applicant could have gotten a patent with a term 9 months less than he wants if he filed a terminal disclaimer. Now, if we agree with you here and hold that we're bound by obviousness-type double patenting law, what happens? Can they come back again and file that terminal disclaimer, is that issue lost and they've lost their patent application?
I think as long as the application is still pending, Your Honor, I think they haven't lost it. I'm not 100% sure whether or not they would have to file a continuation of this application to keep it going, because this application is right in front of the court. But I believe they can still, as long as it's still pending and it hasn't terminated, the proceedings are still live and it's a pending application, I believe there is a procedural way for them to still file their terminal disclaimer.
Well,
they can't reopen prosecution, but they can continue it.
If it was still pending, it wouldn't be final for purposes of appeal.
Well, no, Your Honor. When I say pending, I mean, although it's still pending, the application is still alive because it's on appeal before the court, but prosecution is closed before the agency. The agency is no longer allowing prosecution. However, what they can do, because the proceedings have not terminated, they have a right, I believe, to file a continuing application off of this application, and then they could file their terminal disclaimer. I think they could do that.
Anything further, counsel?
No, Your Honor, I have nothing further, and I apologize for all the technical difficulties, but I appreciate you the court being willing to listen to me and wait for me.
We don't attribute the difficulties to you or your client. Mr. Fanning has a little rebuttal time.
Thank you. Let me address first this terminal disclaimer issue, where Sawstock can still get a patent if we file a terminal disclaimer. Okay. But the claims in the two applications are very different. The earlier patent claims a woodworking machine with a circular blade on a shaft.
The merits are not before us.
I know. I just want to explain why we think a terminal disclaimer is insufficient, is an insufficient remedy. Because the coverage of the two claims are different. One does not infringe the other, and the other doesn't go back that way. And so by filing a terminal disclaimer, SawStop must give up patent term that Congress says we should be able to get. That's our argument.
We understand. That's your argument.
That's our argument. Now, on the AbbVie case that was mentioned, that there's a sentence in that case that talks about double patenting, quote, is grounded in the text of the Patent Act. That's the closest statement I've seen in a case saying that there's a statutory basis for obviousness-type double patenting. But in that same paragraph at the end, the court then goes on and says, obviousness-type double patenting is, quote, grounded in public policy. So it kind of says both, I guess, or kind of wishy-washy. Wanted to make that point.
Is the doctrine addressed in the Uruguay Rounds Act, not the act that we passed?
The one that the URAA, the Uruguay Rounds,
right.
Something Act. not that I know of. I think that might have been the one where a proposition was made
it's
to
the,
include.
It's the statement of administration, which enacts the Uruguay Round requirements. And I think it is addressed in there. I'm not sure that's
okay.
What I'm asking. And if it is, under our law, that's a statute.
Yeah,
the statement of administrative action. That's what it's called. And I think it's, I believe it is addressed in there, in the section that deals with the change to first to file.
I'm unaware of that.
Okay, and just be aware that that is a, under our law, that statement of administrative action is a statute.
Thank you. I want to also address one point that was raised. You know, we talk a lot when we talk about obviousness type double patenting is, you know, you don't want to get this unjustified extension patent term. I get it. But the bargain for a patent goes two ways. You know, the inventor is disclosing to the public information. And in exchange, the inventor gets a patent. And so when you kind of weigh this, what's the public, you know, is the public being harmed? Weigh also the fact that the inventor might be harmed. There's two sides to that bargain. And in this case, SawStop is denied a patent because of that. So I wanted to mention that. It's a two-way street there. And then there was a question about the genesis of this. My reading of the Supreme Court cases was that they considered statutory double patenting, what we would today call statutory double patenting, not obviousness-type double patenting. I believe the genesis is with Judge Rich in footnote 4 of Zickendrot. That's the earliest I've been able to see, the first articulation of it.
Well, first of all, he said that obviousness-type double patenting has been around for decades. And then he cited a 1932 CCPA case for that. I don't think you can say Zickendrot was the first articulation of the ODP doctrine.
After your question, I go back and read the case again, but I don't think he said it that explicitly. I think we're reading it that way, and that's not what he said, but we'll see.
Okay, well, this court has said ODP has been around for over a century.
I don't know about the century part, but okay.
And then, are you familiar with Miller versus Eagle?
The Supreme Court case? The
1894 Supreme Court case, where it said, if the second patent be identical with or only a colorable variation from the first patent, then the second patent will be void, as a patentee cannot take two patents from the same invention. And then later it says, the second patent needs to be essentially distinct and separable from the invention covered by the first patent for the validity to be sustained. And then goes on to say it must be something substantially different. It must be something more than a mere distinction of the breadth or scope of the claims of the first patent. So this Supreme Court opinion from 1894, it doesn't seem to be contemplating a doctrine that is limited to identical claim scope in the second patent compared to the first patent.
It's looking
for something substantially different in order to merit the second patent to go forward and not be voided in view of what is covered by the first patent.
I would ask the court just to consider whether that language goes as far as obviousness or whether it's saying, essentially the same. Is that the same as we interpret the same today? does it go as far as obviousness? Because that seems to be, you know, Judge Rich's footnote. That's why he has the footnote there. The two other judges in the panel said the same invention. He said a different invention because, anyway, you get it. Anyway, I see my, oh, I got 18 seconds.
No, that's a red light. Oh,
that's a red light. My mistake.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Take the case under submission. That concludes our arguments for today.